Please welcome Dr. Tel Beiser.
Even though most of you were not even born when Hillary Clinton made that phrase famous, nonetheless, you've heard of it, and it has become a very famous and widespread opinion among a lot of people. It takes a village to raise a child, is what Clinton was saying. And that was basically a way for the progressive movement to say the community, the larger village, is more important than the family. And the worst of all, of course, is the individual, the least important. And it's really the other way around. The family is far more important than the village. And there's a wonderful new book out called Love and Economics, It Takes a Family to Raise a Village, by Jennifer Roback Morse. And I just want to read one quick paragraph out of it to whet your appetite for you a little bit. She says, when families fall apart, the Hillary Clintons of the world are standing by, ready to promote ever larger and more intrusive government to pick up the pieces. Fiscal conservatives and libertarians simply cannot be indifferent to the fate of the family. I believe we have a responsibility to inform the public about the public consequences of the private choices people make within their families. The reader will not find a single word in this book or in any of my other writings advocating government support programs or regulatory schemes to promote my views of the family. I believe we can change the world by changing our own values and actions. It's a wonderful book, Love and Economics, Love and Economics by Jennifer Roback Morse, and I hope that you will take an opportunity to get that book and read it. It is a truly humane book by a very fine economist. Next, I'd like to call your attention to the fact that there's a clipboard, not the one I lost, which I still haven't found, there's a clipboard going to be coming around that has a petition on it, and I would invite you to add your signature and email address to that petition. This is something that you'll see more of the rationale for in the actual talk that I'm going to give for you this morning. The idea is to protect the poor of the world from the harmful effects of climate change policy being promoted by the U.S. government and by other major governments around the world. Now, I was actually asked to speak to you this morning on the relationship of population, economy, and resources, and particularly to address the problem of so-called overpopulation. But I think that really there's a huge, huge danger facing us that I would rather get you acquainted with. So I'm going to give you a super quick summary of what I would have said about population. One, there is no such thing as overpopulation. It is, in fact, impossible to define the term overpopulation by any demographic terms. You can't do it by population density, you can't do it by population growth rate, you can't do it by population age distribution. None of those demographic terms can define what people think of as overpopulation. What they really have in mind is poverty. Poverty is the source of all the different problems that get assigned to dense population, rapidly growing population, population with an extra large elderly portion or an extra large young portion, something like that. No, poverty is the real problem, not population. Why is that? It's because human beings made in God's image are creative and productive as God is, and the more of us there are, the more we interact with each other and the more creative and productive we become. Therefore, we actually produce more resources than we consume in our lifetimes, which is why, on average, each generation is better off than the generation that came before it. And it's also why we are not running out of resources and we are not in danger of running out of resources. The long-term price trend of all extractive resources, mineral, plant, and animal, is downward with only one exception, and that's human beings. The price of human beings, measured in terms of wages per hour worked, the price of human beings is going up, which tells us, since price is a measure of scarcity, that human beings are becoming more scarce over time rather than less scarce, even though our numbers are growing. Because scarcity is not an absolute measure, it's a measure of the relationship between supply and demand. So, there you go. There's my whole lecture on that, to acquaint you with it quickly. I've covered it very thoroughly in my book, Prospects for Growth, a biblical view of population, resources, and the environment. That is out of print, but again, Amazon.com and various other book-finding resources online, you can find it used at very low prices. Well, let's see. Now, why have I decided to change the topic of this lecture? It's because the debate over climate change is really crucial to human well-being in terms of both material prosperity and, even more important than that, liberty. Climate change, or the idea of dangerous man-made global warming, has become the biggest rationale for fighting so-called overpopulation through government family planning programs that often include forced sterilization and forced abortion, forcing us to change our energy systems in order to use so-called renewable fuels instead of fossil fuels, the result of which is to impoverish those who have already climbed out of poverty and to trap in poverty those who are still in it. It also is to enormously expand the power of government over our lives. So I want to speak to you this morning about climate science, energy policy, poverty, and Christian faith, and how all of those things connect together. This is going to be in the form of my actually responding almost point by point to a major article that was published in Forbes magazine a couple of months ago by a climate scientist, in which he was arguing that dangerous man-made warming is for real, that it's a serious problem, that we really need to use enormous transformations of our society in order to fight it, despite the fact that those things would be extremely expensive and would slow the rise out of poverty for people around the world. This is an issue that you and I are going to continue to face probably for at least another couple of decades, perhaps three decades. You need to be equipped to be able to help fight this battle. So in the March 16 issue of Forbes, astrophysicist Ethan Siegel's article, "The Next Great Global Warming Hiatus is Coming," sought to refute skeptics of catastrophic anthropogenic global warming, which is the more technical way of saying dangerous man-made global warming. Catastrophic, meaning it brings on catastrophe. Anthropogenic, it originates with man, anthropos, global warming. He sought to refute skeptics of catastrophic anthropogenic global warming, which I will from now on call CAGW, by arguing that the apparent lack of statistically significant global warming over roughly the last 18 or 19 years is just one in a series of lulls in a long-term warming trend for which human action is responsible. His article, deftly argued and accompanied by stunning graphs, is one of the best defenses of fears of CAGW I have seen in the 25 years that I have been studying and debating in this issue. So I'd like to begin my presentation by responding to it in some length. Siegel begins with two frightening graphs. The first showing that during the first half of March, most of North America was about 4.2 degrees Celsius warmer than the 1981 to 2010 average. And the second showing that for December 2015 through February 2016, the surface temperature of much of the world was warmer than at any time in the previous 67 years. In both of those graphs, the red areas are the most warmer, and the blue areas are the least warmer, and then there's a continuum between those. Scientists who believe in CAGW routinely use these sorts of images to generate fears. The scary colors certainly help, but are of purely emotional, not rational value. Consider what happens if we turn that last graph from color to grayscale. Doesn't look nearly so scary, does it? Now, I'm not arguing that colors shouldn't be used, just pointing out that viewers need to distinguish between the emotional effect of alarming colors, like the reds in that graph, and the rational information being conveyed, and perhaps amplified by the colors. But Siegel seems to undercut these graphs by explaining, The first thing we have to realize is that there are two things at play here. Long-term trends, which is the gradual warming we're seeing over generational timescales, and short-term variations, which are due to things like the seasons, volcanic eruptions, and weather events like El Nino and La Nina. The record-breaking temperatures we're seeing across the globe are due to a combination of all the short-term and long-term variations superimposed atop one another. And so, although last month, February of 2016, when his article was published, was the hottest month ever recorded, I'm going to interrupt there. No, don't think this means through all human history. We haven't been recording global temperature directly for more than about a century, or very well for more than about 38 years. And the proxy temperature measurements going back farther give pretty good evidence that, for example, the medieval warm period was warmer than today. But to return to Siegel's article, although last month was the hottest month ever recorded, that isn't necessarily a reason to freak out. You see, we're currently experiencing an El Nino event. This peak in temperatures that we're seeing now, the one that spans from 2015 to 2016, isn't due to global warming. That is to say, most of the anomalously high temperatures we're seeing are due to these short-term variations. Now, isn't that reassuring? Siegel is no alarmist, is he? Maybe he even rejects alarmism. Well, don't be too quick to breathe a sigh of relief. He immediately adds, but what should be far more concerning to anyone who wants to know the truth about climate change is this. The long-term rise in temperatures is continuing at a steady rate. The fact that temperatures appear to be rising at a rate between 0.4 and 0.8 degree per century, unabated, is the real cause for concern. That's what global warming really is, the slow, long-term rise in temperatures. That's also the component that humans, through emissions reduction, energy efficiency, renewable power, policy changes, and possibly geoengineering, can do something about. Now, before we go further, let me point out that the rate of change in global average temperature of 0.4 to 0.8 degrees per century is remarkably small. On any given day in many locales, the difference between high and low temperature is 10 to 20 times that. And in any given year, in most locales, the difference between summer and winter highs or summer and winter lows is 20 to 40 or more times that. Which is why my good friend Dr. Richard Lindzen, who is Alfred P. Sloan Professor of Meteorology Emeritus at MIT, says the proper response to the entire roughly 0.8 to 1.0 degree increase in global average temperature since 1880 is, so what? Now let's get to the point of Siegel's article, The Next Great Global Warming Hiatus, and he's got that word in scare quotes, is coming. That title is a jab at skeptics of CAGW. Siegel warns readers that since the record-breaking temperatures of the last few months, which will probably continue for a good part of this year before El Nino peters out, will soon be followed by the cooling caused by La Nina, which normally follows, the skeptics will therefore immediately start claiming that global warming has stopped, or at least paused, since it could well be a decade or two or three before the long-term warming with another unusually strong El Nino superimposed on it brings us to new record highs. He illustrates his point powerfully with an animated graph from the website skepticalscience.com, which is a totally propagandistic alarmist site, showing the difference between how what he calls skeptics, and he should be credited here, by the way, for using this nicer term than deniers, which rhetorically associates those who question CAGW with those who deny the Holocaust. This first graph shows how skeptics view global warming and how what he can, and another one shows how realists view it. Notice in this one about skeptics, they see these plateaus in the midst of this. but realists, he says, view it this way, right? So let's go back and forth between those so their message sinks in. In both, the green lines with circles in them show the average annual global surface temperatures according to five widely recognized sources. In this first graph, how skeptics view global warming, the nearly level and sometimes even downward sloping blue lines show the pauses in global warming, and according to Siegel, the skeptics point to any given pause as evidence that global warming has stopped. Now, actually, most don't, but argue from them in a different way that I'll raise shortly. But as the red line in the second graph shows, how realists view global warming, the long-term trend is clearly upward, and the pauses are really just that, pauses. None of them is a cessation. By the way, notice the scare quotes around skeptics, how skeptics view global warming, but the absence of any around realists. That's another rhetorical trick designed to shift your thinking without persuading you, just like calling his side realists, for of course, no one wants to question reality. Obviously, the long-term warming continues, despite the short-term pauses. Siegel then warns that prominent climatologists have made these arguments before and will likely make them again, and they will be quoted in a great many news outlets and by numerous science writers. But then he advises, if you see an article that cites one of them claiming global warming has stopped, and it isn't yet 2033, the 17 years from now that we're required to wait to see if the rise continues, please refer them back to this article. Convinced? Well, Siegel thinks you should be, so he concludes, the fact that the global average temperature is rising and that it continues to rise is a real long-term problem facing the entire world. Don't let dishonest arguments that gloss over the actual issue dissuade you from the scientific facts. How does he know they're dishonest, by the way? He just kind of slips that in there, didn't he? He hasn't given you any proof that the people who give these arguments are being dishonest, are saying things that they themselves know are not true, right? He goes on, we can fool ourselves into believing that there isn't a problem until it's too late to do anything about it, or we can own up to what the science, as if science were monolithic, tells us, and face this problem with the full force of human ingenuity. The choice is ours. Well, yes, we do have some choices to make. But before we make them, I'd like to do a little testing of Siegel's reasoning, which is quite representative of that by CAGW advocates generally. Let's begin by considering his caveat. If you see an article claiming global warming has stopped, and it isn't yet 2033, the 17 years from now that we're required to wait to see if the rise continues, please refer them back to this article. So Siegel thinks the 17-year pause can fit comfortably in with the theory of CAGW, which is that human emissions of CO2 are driving dangerous global warming. There are some problems with that. The first problem is that the least squares linear regression of satellite global temperature data showed no global warming from February 1997 through October 2015, 18 years and 9 months. That's more than 50% longer than the roughly 12 years shown in the last pause of the How Skeptics View Global Warming graph that Siegel used, and about 10% longer than the 17 years Siegel thinks would be consistent with his theory. The current short-term warming Siegel attributes to El Nino, and others attribute in part also to a reversal of the Pacific decadal oscillation from negative to positive, the two combined making for even more warming, has shortened the pause, as illustrated in this graph, to 18 years and 8 months instead of 18 and 9. June 1997 to January 2016, and will shorten it further as El Nino's influence continues. But the fact remains that at its maximum, the period without warming significantly exceeded 17 years. Now, the second problem is that even climate scientists who embrace CAGW previously admitted that a period of just 15 years without warming would be difficult, if not impossible, to reconcile with the theory. In its State of the Climate 2018, the National Atmospheric and Oceanic Administration stated, near zero and even negative trends are common for intervals of a decade or less in the simulation, due to the model's internal climate variability. The simulations rule out at the 95% level, that's like almost certainty as far as empirical science is concerned, the simulations rule out at the 95% level zero trends for intervals of 15 years or more, suggesting that an observed absence of warming of this duration is needed to create a discrepancy with the expected present-day warming rate. Likewise, Phil Jones, director of the Climatic Research Unit at the University of East Anglia, said in an email to a colleague in 2009, bottom line, the no upward trend has to continue for a total of 15 years before we get worried. Now, that was at the time when the no upward trend had lasted for about 9 years. So you can see that he was kind of just putting the doomsday off into the future a little bit, right? So where did Siegel come up with 17 years? I don't find it anywhere in the data. Now, the third problem is that the periods with and without warming over the last 40 years or so are about equal in length, which suggests that if the periods without warming aren't sufficient to invalidate the climate models, neither are the periods with warming sufficient to validate them. Now let's go back to what I consider the most important paragraph of Siegel's article. The fact that temperatures appear to be rising at a rate of between 0.4 and 0.8 degrees per century, unabated, is the real cause for concern. That's what global warming really is, the slow, long-term rise in temperatures. That's also the component that humans can do something about. Now, in short, Siegel recommends that we do something about this long-term temperature rise through emission reductions, energy efficiency, renewable power, policy changes, and possibly geoengineering. I'll address his prescription later, but it's time now to consider a very intriguing fact. Without acknowledging it, Siegel implicitly gives away the score when he says temperatures appear to be rising at a rate of between 0.4 and 0.8 degrees per century, unabated. Ignore for the moment his saying that the rise is at a steady rate or unabated when the pauses, even in the graph he offers, show clearly that it is not steady but regularly abated. The key is in the rate he affirms, 0.4 to 0.8 degrees per century. How does this give away the score? Well, the computer climate models on which the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, various national agencies, and various climate change advocacy groups rely for their forecasts of anthropogenic global warming, dangerous enough to justify abatement policies costing hundreds of billions to trillions of dollars, predict that global average temperature should be rising at a rate of about 0.214 degrees per decade, in other words, about 2.14 degrees per century. And that's only the warming that should be coming from human emissions of CO2. If any of the long-term warming trend is natural, the combined trend should be even higher. But as climatologist John Christie of the University of Alabama, one of the best known of the skeptics, has shown, the actually observed warming rate is about 0.079 degrees Celsius, according to weather balloon data, or 0.091 degrees Celsius, according to satellite data, per decade. This graph shows the projections for mid-tropospheric temperature variations by 102 climate models, grouped into 32 groups in the dotted lines and as an overall average in the thick red line. It also shows the annual average of four weather balloon data sets in the green line with circles and of three satellite data sets in the blue line with squares. All the data are graphed so that the trend lines meet at zero in 1979. In other words, it's an index. As you can see, the model projections diverged rapidly from the observations in the early 1980s. From 1995 to about 2000, they rarely intersect the observations, and from 2000 onward, they never intersect the observations. The second graph shows the same data plotted as straight-line trends. The red line shows the average of 102 computer models, the blue line, the observations by weather balloons, and the green line, the observations by satellites. As these graphs show, the models predict about 2.4 to 2.7 times as much warming as the satellite and balloon data show. Now, as an aside, let me point out, in case you're concerned because Christie's data are for the mid-troposphere, while Siegel's are for surface temperatures, according to greenhouse warming theory, the mid-troposphere should warm more than the surface. So these data don't imply underestimates of surface warming trends. Now, what warming rate did Siegel say is a real cause for concern that humans can do something about? 0.4 to 0.8 degrees per century. or 0.04 to 0.08 per decade. The computer models predict, on average, about 2.8 times as much warming as Siegel's upper-end estimate of the observed long-term warming rate, and 5.4 times as much as his lower-end estimate. Further, Siegel's lower-end estimate of the observed warming rate, 0.04 degrees Celsius per decade, is about half the balloon estimate and about per decade, and his upper-end estimate is about 9/10 of the satellite estimate of 0.09 per decade. In short, Siegel's estimates of the actual warming rate are more skeptical than the skeptics' estimates. Now let me back up to one of Siegel's planes that I told you a little bit about a little bit ago to ignore for a moment, that the observed warming has been at a steady rate, unabated. As I said then, the nearly flat blue lines in the graph he offers, labeled How Skeptics View Global Warming, show that the warming is not steady, but is regularly abated. But that's not the only problem. The claim by those who believe in CAGW is that human emissions of CO2 have caused most of the global warming since about 1960. If CO2 is the primary driver, then the temperature trend should follow it closely. But here's what atmospheric CO2 concentration has done over that period. The red squiggly line shows the seasonal variation because CO2 concentration rises in the northern hemisphere winter as plants go dormant and absorb less, and falls in summer as plants grow and absorb more. And the black line shows the smoothed average. What is clear is that CO2's rise has been, shall we say, borrowing Siegel's words that inaccurately describes global average temperature, CO2's rise has been steady and unabated, not intermittent, like temperatures. In short, while the correlation between CO2 and temperature over the entire time is reasonably close, CO2's curve does not show the intermittency that the temperature data show, which means the correlation is poor. But poor does not equal non-existent. There is, in fact, a correlation between atmospheric CO2 concentration and global average temperature. The problem for those who, like Siegel, insist that our CO2 emissions are the primary driver of global warming over the last half century or so, is that the sequence is opposite of what it should be for that theory to be true. Temperature changes before CO2, not vice versa. Over very long time scales, measured in hundreds of thousands to millions of years, if you are an old Earth geologist, and as young Earth geologists, we need to reinterpret these into our own paradigms, but this is an ad hominem argument, meaning I'm saying, all right, let's assume that your view is right. What happens when we do that for a minute? We're going to show that your review self-refutes. Over very long time scales, a study of Antarctic ice cores dating back 270,000 years, published in Science in 1999, showed that CO2 concentrations lagged temperature by from 200 to 1,000 years. But what about shorter time scales? As illustrated in this graph, a study by Humlam et al., published in Global and Planetary Change in 2013, examining the lags and leads between a number of annually averaged variables, including surface air temperature from, I'm not going to list those, a number of different data sets. This study concluded that changes in the amount of atmospheric CO2 always lag behind corresponding changes in air temperature, with the maximum positive correlation between CO2 and temperature found for CO2 lagging 11 to 12 months in relation to global sea surface temperatures, 9.5 to 10 months to global surface air temperature, and about 9 months to global lower troposphere temperature. Moreover, as Cornwall Alliance Senior Fellow and University of Delaware Climatology Professor David LeGates explains in commenting on those studies, changes in ocean temperatures are good predictors of the observed changes in atmospheric CO2. Because seawater releases CO2 as it warms and sequesters it as it cools, while CO2 released from anthropogenic sources are not well correlated with changes in total atmospheric CO2. In other words, the alarmists get the whole thing bass backwards. You know what a bass is? You flip that around and it goes backward. They get the whole thing reversed. Temperature leads CO2, not the other way around. Now, I'll conclude this portion of my presentation with the observation that, as shown in these paired graphs, climate models run hot. The gray bars are based on 117 model simulations, and the black curves are smooth versions of their simulated trends. The red hatching depicts observed trends from 100 reconstructions of the Hadgroup 4, that's a very widely used data set, global temperature data set. The left graph covers 1993 to 2012, for which period only two of the gray bars fall within the red hatching. In other words, only two came close to matching reality, right? The right graph covers the shorter period, 1998 to 2012, for which period only one gray bar falls within the red hatching. As we saw earlier with the comparison of model simulations to satellite and weather balloon observations, the overwhelming majority of the simulations depicts more than twice the warming actually observed. Nobel Prize-winning physicist Richard Feynman explained the key to science this way. In general, we look for a new law by the following process. First, we guess it. Then we compute the consequences of the guess to see what would be implied if this law that we guessed is right. Then we compare the result of the computation to nature with experiment or experience, compare it directly with observation to see if it works. If it disagrees with experiment, it is wrong. And that simple statement is the key to science. It does not make any difference how beautiful your guess is, does not make any difference how smart you are, who made the guess, or what his name is, and I'll add, or how many people agree with you. If it disagrees with experiment, it is wrong. That is all there is to it. So that's your answer to the notion that there is overwhelming consensus among scientists about global warming. Doesn't matter. Consensus has been overturned many, many times in the history of science. This is why more and more climate scientists around the world are reassessing just how much warming should come from CO2 added to the atmosphere. The term for this is climate sensitivity, which climate scientists define as the amount that global average temperature should rise in response to doubled atmospheric CO2 concentration. Whereas the IPCC has, since 1988, estimated climate sensitivity at 1.5 to 4.5 degrees Celsius with 3 degrees as best estimate, based on models, climate scientists incorporating increasingly empirical data are offering significantly lower estimates, as this graph shows. You can see, over time, the estimates of climate sensitivity fall. The more recent science estimates very little warming effect from added CO2. Keep in mind that the last of those studies was published in 2013. After that, the so-called pause in global warming extended through two more years, offering additional reason to reduce both, to reduce estimates of climate sensitivity. As the Cornwall Alliance pointed out in A Call to Truth, Prudence and Protection of the Poor 2014, the case against harmful climate policies gets stronger, which is on our website. Newer observationally based estimates have ranges like 0.3 to 1 degree Celsius from the non-governmental International Panel on Climate Change to 1.25 to 3 degrees with the best estimate of 1.75 degrees by Lewis and Koch. Now I'll conclude this portion of my presentation this way. I think it's highly likely that adding CO2 to the atmosphere will make global average temperature warmer than it otherwise would be, all other things being equal. But I think the magnitude of the warming will be much less, most likely in the range of 1/3 to 1/2, but perhaps even as little as 1/6 of that predicted by the IPCC and other advocates of CAGW. Because, on average, the computer climate models on which advocates of CAGW depend simulate 2 to 3 times the actually observed warming, and because over 95% simulate more warming than observed, which implies that the errors are not random, in which case they'd be equally often and equally much below as above the observations, but rather the errors are driven by some kind of bias, whether honest mistake or dishonest fudging, written right into the models, and because none of the models predicted the nearly 19-year absence of statistically significant global warming starting in early 1997, we can safely conclude that the models are invalidated. This in turn means they provide no rational basis for predictions about future temperature or anything dependent on it, whether extreme weather events, rate of sea level rise, or changes in ecosystems. And that in turn means they provide no rational basis for any policy in response to any such predictions. At the same time, however, literally thousands of empirical, not modeling, but empirical studies reveal that adding CO2 to the atmosphere has tremendous beneficial effects for all living things. On average, for every doubling of CO2 concentration in the atmosphere, there's a 35% increase in plant growth efficiency. Plants grow better in warmer and colder temperatures, and in wetter and drier soils. They make better use of soil nutrients and resist diseases and pests better, widening their ranges, and, as shown in this graph, greening the planet. They improve their fruit-to-fiber ratio, and the result is more food for everything that eats plants, and everything that eats things that eat plants. Estimates of increased agricultural productivity due to the CO2 we've added to the atmosphere since about 1950 range from about 11% to 15%, with added crop value since 1960 estimated at $3.2 trillion. Who benefits most from this? The world's poor, who are most vulnerable to high food prices and benefit most from declining food prices. So it's not only all the direct benefits of the energy we produce from fossil fuels, energy to light our homes and workplaces, to operate all our transport and communication systems, to run our hospitals, factories, and refrigerators, indeed, almost everything we do all day, every day. It's not only all those direct benefits in terms of energy, but also the indirect benefit of the biological enhancement from rising atmospheric CO2 that we owe to our use of fossil fuels. Any alleged costs from CO2's influence on climate must be balanced against such gains, and any alleged climate-related benefits of reducing our CO2 emissions must be balanced against the reduction of these benefits. Now, this brings us to another aspect of this controversy, the one that, because of the Bible's insistence on helping and protecting the poor, motivates my work in this field: the wisdom of policies prescribed to mitigate anthropogenic global warming. All of those policies emphasize the need to reduce CO2 emissions, and all call for us to do that by, quote, decarbonizing, unquote, the world's energy systems, substituting renewable energy sources, especially wind and solar, for hydrocarbon, otherwise known as fossil fuels. I'm going to begin this discussion by asking you what you might think is a rather strange question. How many calories do you consume each day? If you're about average for Americans, your answer was probably about 2,700. And if it was, you're way off. Actually, the average American consumes about 186,000 calories per day. Impossible, you say? Well, only if you count only food intake. But calories are measures of energy, and most of the calories we consume don't come from food. They come from the energy we use when we turn on a light or computer, drive our cars, use our cell phones, or do pretty much anything else. Add that all up, and for the average American, it comes to about 186,000 calories per day, about 60 times as many calories as we get from food. And 98% of that energy is in the form of machine power. It serves us, minute by minute, uncomplaining, and it's largely responsible for the fact that Americans born today can expect to live nearly three times as long as their ancestors born before the Industrial Revolution. Very few, perhaps one in a thousand, one in a hundred of our ancestors consumed that much energy in a day. And for them, very little of it was in the form of machine power. It was instead mostly in the form of animal and slave labor. The animals and slaves got their energy from food, and in those days, average daily calorie intake from food per person was probably under 2,000, meaning that for anyone to benefit from 186,000 calories of energy per day required harnessing the energy equivalent and the production equivalent of about 93 slaves. Today, instead, we get most of our energy from fossil fuels. Worldwide, about 87% of all energy consumed comes from fossil fuels, and most of the remainder from hydro, about 7%, and nuclear, about 4%. Harnessing energy through machines instead of animals and slaves enables us to benefit from a level of energy consumption that only a tiny minority had three centuries ago, even while we've abolished slavery. What this means is that the energy we derive from fossil fuels provides two great moral benefits. First, about 87% of all the products and services that give us longer, healthier lives than our ancestors. And second, the elimination of the demand for slave labor. That's right. Energy from fossil fuels played an integral role in the elimination of slavery from Western civilization. Today, however, environmentalists call our use of fossil fuels an addiction, analogous to smoking tobacco or taking hallucinogenic drugs. They warn that by obtaining energy from coal, oil, and natural gas, we're causing dangerous global warming, a claim I've just argued is at best grossly exaggerated. They demand that we curtail that use, even stop it completely, even at a cost of literally trillions of dollars that otherwise could go to reducing hunger and disease and increasing education, health care, and other benefits worldwide. One might as well demand that the average person cut his food intake from 2,700 calories a day to 300, because the other 1,400 are his addiction to food. Abundant, affordable, reliable energy is indispensable to lifting and keeping whole societies out of poverty. And fossil fuels are, and for decades to come will remain, along with nuclear and hydro, the best sources. The ministry I lead, the Cornwall Alliance for the Stewardship of Creation, has just published a new edition of the excellent study, Fossil Fuels, the Moral Case. In it, my friend Kathleen Hartnett White, former chairman and commissioner of the Texas Commission on Environmental Quality, traces some of the benefits that come from fossil fuels. I brought copies with me. They're available on our table, and I would urge you to pick one up and read it. You need to understand this, because this is probably the biggest policy issue that is running in American government today, and it's not going to quit soon. Don't misunderstand me. As my friend Dr. Will Happer, Cyrus Clogg Brackett Professor of Physics at Princeton Emeritus, and former director of the U.S. Department of Energy's Office of Science, notes in a forthcoming paper, fossil fuels must be extracted responsibly, minimizing environmental damage from mining and drilling operations, and with due consideration of costs and benefits. Similarly, fossil fuels must be burned responsibly, deploying cost-effective technologies that minimize emissions of real pollutants such as fly ash, carbon monoxide, oxides of sulfur and nitrogen, heavy metals, volatile organic compounds, etc. Those are the real risks from fossil fuels, and in developed countries, we apply technologies that minimize them. But carbon dioxide is not a pollutant, and because human material well-being depends heavily on access to abundant, affordable, reliable energy, and because fossil fuels are, and for the foreseeable future, will continue to be, along with nuclear and hydro, our best source of such energy, the demand to reduce our use of fossil fuels, to reduce our CO2 emissions, to reduce man-made global warming, amounts to a demand to reduce human material well-being, which I believe is immoral. Consider six graphs demonstrating the relationship between hydrocarbon fuel use and three measures of human well-being: infant and child mortality, human life expectancy, and income per capita. This first graph shows the relationship between CO2 emissions per person and child mortality in 1940. In this graph, each circle represents a country. The sizes of the circles indicate relative population, and the colors indicate GDP per capita by nation. Yellow is high GDP per capita, that is wealthy. Green is upper middle, red is lower middle, blue is low, and colorless is not categorized. The higher a circle falls on the scale, the higher the per capita emissions of CO2. The farther to the right a circle falls, the higher the child mortality rate. So, let's see if I have a pointer here. So, these circles over here indicate higher child mortality rate, right? These circles up here indicate higher CO2 emissions per capita, right? You notice that as child mortality rate declines, moving to the left, CO2 emissions per capita rise, going up. Right? So, 1940, for the vast majority of the world's people, CO2 emissions clustered under 0.5 ton per capita, and child mortality rate clustered between 200 and 400 deaths by age 5 per 1,000 born. Higher emissions, lower child mortality rates, and higher income levels clearly correlated positively. 69 years later, the circles have shifted to the left, showing declining child mortality rates. They've also shifted upward, showing rising CO2 emissions. In 2009, for the vast majority of the world's people, CO2 emissions cluster between 2 and 10 tons per capita, 4 to 40 times the 1940 levels. And child mortality rates cluster between 20 and 60 deaths by age 5 per 1,000 born, about one-third to one-twentieth the 1940 rates. Higher emissions, lower child mortality rates, and higher income levels, again, clearly correlate. Now, we'll compare 1940 and 2009 measures of human life expectancy. Here, the circle's horizontal location represents life expectancy, right? So the farther off to the right, the higher the life expectancy, the farther to the left, the lower the life expectancy. And again, their vertical position represents the CO2 emissions per capita. In 1940, for the vast majority of the world's people, when CO2 emissions, we remember, clustered under half a ton per capita, life expectancy clustered between 25 and 40 years. In 2009, for the vast majority of the world's people, with CO2 emissions 4 to 40 times higher, life expectancy clusters between 65 and 75 years. About 60 to 300% higher than in 1940. Again, higher emissions, higher life expectancy, and income levels clearly correlate. Now, this next graph is perhaps the most dramatic. It graphs GDP per capita on the vertical scale as a function of hydrocarbon fuel use on the horizontal scale from 1800 to 2010. If we value human material well-being, we want to see GDP per capita rising. It does so only as hydrocarbon fuel use also rises. The call to reduce our use of carbon-based fuels is, by implication, a call to reduce wealth. As of 2010, the world GDP per capita was approaching $9,000, about one-fifth what it was in the United States at the time. To return to the 1990 level of hydrocarbon fuel use would be to cut world GDP per capita by about two-fifths of that. To return to the 1970 level would be to cut it by about two-thirds. As we see in this next graph, according to the IPCC's coupled climate and economic modeling, the world's poorer nations, measured by per capita income, become richest at the end of this century and the next under the warmest scenarios. These are the warmer scenarios. And these are the ones where the countries that are now the poorest become the richest. I lost my spot here. Why does that happen? Well, it happens because the climate models derive the magnitude of warming from the amount of economic growth, and they assume the economic growth to be driven primarily by fossil fuel use, which is true. The lower the fossil fuel use, in other words, the more successful the efforts to mitigate global warming by reducing CO2 emissions, the lower the economic growth, and vice versa. The higher the fossil fuel use, the higher the economic growth. In other words, even according to the IPCC's own modeling, and the IPCC is the ground zero of climate alarmism, even according to its own modeling, assuming high climate sensitivity, how much warming comes from added CO2, even though, as we've seen, empirical observation increasingly points to low climate sensitivity, fighting global warming does more harm than good as measured by income per capita. As an aside, here's an ethical point to consider. Under all the IPCC's scenarios, future generations are wealthier than the present generation. Calling for people today to bear the burden of trillions of dollars worth of climate mitigation by decarbonizing their energy systems means asking the poorer of today to sacrifice for the sake of the richer of tomorrow. Why is it so important to consider the impact of CO2 reductions on economies? Because of this simple insight. The wealthier you are, the more different climates in which you can thrive. and the better able you are to survive extreme weather. The corollary is that the poorer you are, the less able you are to thrive in any climate or to survive any extreme weather event. If your wealth, if your income is even equivalent to today's lower middle class in America, you can live a healthy, safe, long life in any climate, from the Arctic desert to the Arctic Circle to the Sahara Desert or the Brazilian rainforest. If you're poor, you can't thrive in the most idyllic tropical paradise. These insights yield this implication. Since abundant, affordable, reliable energy promotes wealth, and nuclear and fossil fuels are now and for the foreseeable future will be our best sources of said energy, those sources enhance human thriving and survival, and human thriving and survival are reduced proportionate to the reduction in humans' use of them. As my friend John Christie, a climatologist at the University of Alabama and former missionary in Kenya, explains, the primitive energy system dominant among the world's poorest 1.3 or so billion people works this way. The average woman in sub-Saharan Africa spends 6 to 8 hours a day gathering wood and dung as her primary cooking and heating fuel, leaving her precious little time and bodily energy for other productive activities to lift herself and her children out of poverty. Smoke from that kills about 4 million people a year, mostly women and children, and debilitates hundreds of millions for varying periods and at varying degrees because it causes upper respiratory diseases and eye infections. The poor of this world desperately need to replace that primitive energy system with the modern one, in which coal, natural gas, and nuclear materials are used to generate clean electricity delivered at scale, meaning in utterly enormous quantities, far beyond anything you will imagine. On demand, meaning it's there every time, instantly, when you need it. Without interruption, meaning with no brownouts or blackouts. Through grids not only for cooking and heating, but also for light and refrigeration, and automated clothes washing and drying, and computing, and industry, and business, and commerce, and healthcare. Some people will respond to all of this by saying, I understand that energy is important to lifting and keeping people out of poverty, but why does it have to be fossil fuel energy? Why not power our grids with wind, solar, and biofuels to minimize global warming? The answer is cost. As this chart from the Institute for Energy Research shows, it's less expensive to generate the vast amount of steady, on-demand, uninterrupted electricity from fossil fuels than from wind and solar. Don't be deceived. While the estimated cost of new electric generating technology for onshore wind, which is over, let's see, onshore wind, where did that go now? I think it's, yeah, that's wind onshore, okay? While that estimated cost is lower than the estimated cost for generating energy from conventional coal, on a straight per megawatt hour basis, there's a tremendous difference. Electricity generated from coal is dispatchable. That's a very important term, dispatchable. In other words, it's instantly available, and it is not vulnerable to the intermittency of wind, sunlight, and river flow. Electricity generated from wind and solar is non-dispatchable. In other words, it's subject to intermittency and requiring instantaneous backup by dispatchable technologies. As the Institute for Energy Research explains, the more non-dispatchable power is used, the more the electrical system requires investments in dispatchable generation forms to back up its increased use. In other words, you have to have coal or natural gas-fired plants running at what's called spinning reserve, very low power, very low efficiency, with more pollution output per megawatt hour of electricity generated. But you have to have those running at the same time that you're getting your electricity from wind and solar, because when wind and solar die down, you have to replace that instantaneously, which means you're having to generate almost double the energy. So government policies that promote the use of non-dispatchable power are equivalent to requiring consumers to buy and care for two vehicles, one that works when you need it, and another that works when it feels like it. The hidden costs of non-dispatchable power are substantial and should not be overlooked as part of the public policy discussion. The campaign to fight global warming by reducing fossil fuel use is, at bottom, a campaign to retain the primitive energy system and its accompanying low incomes and high rates of disease and premature death. It is, in fact, a campaign of anti-humanism. It follows that such a policy should be taken only if its benefits clearly exceed its costs. And that can only be true if the amount of warming caused by our CO2 emissions is very high indeed. In fact, significantly higher than even the alarmist IPCC claims. As we saw earlier, however, climate sensitivity is probably significantly lower than the IPCC claims, leaving no justification for the campaign to decarbonize the world's energy system. The second great commandment is, love your neighbor as yourself. In light of what I've presented here, I believe loving our neighbors implies rejecting the exaggerated claims of anthropogenic global warming, asserting the benefits of both the energy and the biological enhancement effects of fossil fuel use, and therefore rejecting calls to mitigate global warming by reducing CO2 emissions. There are, of course, many more points that could be addressed, so I'll welcome you to raise some questions in the Q&A time today. But first, let me invite you to do these things. One, come to cornwallalliance.org and read the studies and articles there by the roughly 60 scholars in our network. Two, sign our petition, Forget Climate Change, Energy Empowers the Poor, which is what was on that clipboard going around. Three, view our YouTube video series, Greener on the Other Side, Climate Alarmism, Facts Not Fear, in which we interview over 30 world-class scholars in this field. Go to YouTube, search there for Cornwall Alliance for the Stewardship of Creation, or rather, more directly, for Greener on the Other Side on YouTube. Not only see those yourself, but post them on your Facebook. Tell them, tell your friends about them. Let people get educated on this stuff. Fourth, show our new documentary, Where the Grass is Greener, Biblical Stewardship versus Climate Alarmism, to friends and at your church. We have copies of that available at our table. It's crucial that people learn this information. Go to our website and read an open letter on climate change to the American people and their elected representatives, and add your signature to that and encourage other people to do the same. Subscribe to our email newsletter. Follow and like us on Facebook. We have a Facebook page. And visit earthrisingblog.com, our blog specifically geared toward millennials, by and for millennials, earthrisingblog.com. Now, one last point about that petition that we sent the clipboard around. We have cards with that petition printed on it. And I would love for you to take, say, 5 or 10 each of you, take 5 or 10 of those and pass them on to friends at your church or in other places, and encourage those folks to get acquainted with this as well. This issue is the one that the progressives around the world are using as the rationale to force us to abandon the best energy systems for worse ones, driving people into poverty. It's also the issue that they're using to force us to give government control over more and more of our lives. Since we use energy in absolutely everything we do, if the government controls our energy, it will control us. This is the primary issue on which the globalists are working to achieve global government. That's been said by top leaders in the United Nations, in the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, and in the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. This is not just an esoteric thing. It's something that involves all of us. And if you're familiar with the devastation of communities throughout the Appalachians that had been supported by the coal industry, where thousands and thousands of jobs have been destroyed, you know just how directly harmful that kind of policy can be. Thank you very much. Good morning to you.